You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
How we've organized today's discussion is really Arun and myself will begin with a conversation talking about his work that he is engaging in for the fellowship program here at OSF. And then we are going to open it up to questions. This is an area that, as evidenced by participation, touches on a lot of different interests and issue areas throughout the foundation. We're very happy to be having this conversation and taking a few moments to really delve in deeply into both the changing nature of the U.S. in particular, post 9/11, and also the changing demographics within the country and how the transition and incorporation of new communities into America is happening, and how we see systems of government supporting and promoting that, as well as being a challenge and obstacle to that as well. And part of that discussion to wrestle with these issues of national security, tolerance, religious freedom, and religious and ethnic pluralism really taps into what is our national identity and also our cultural values. And Arun is here to talk both from the perspective of what does it mean to have community have community and community representation, and with the force of the FBI trying to both make connections to the Muslim American community as well as to establish who are the leaders and representatives of those communities. A lot of tensions and issues come up in that, and that's really where we're going to delve into in our conversation. So I want to open it up to you, Arun, as our newest fellow, to just give an opening summary of both what your project will be for the fellowship year, and then we'll go into specifically about this conversation.
Sure. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone, for coming. I'm probably the oldest fellow because I'm just in the last few weeks of my fellowship, so this is going to be about work I've done rather than what I'm planning to do. I think it's useful to start by just talking about this particular project that I'm looking at is looking at the role of counter-radicalization policy, which is a kind of subset of a wider discussion about counter-terrorism and national security. And if you think about where we've come in the last 10 years, the kind of big story about the war on terror domestically has been about kind of mass surveillance, about detention without trial, the Patriot Act, wiretapping. And in a way, that has continued, I think, quite, and in some ways intensified through the Obama administration. The particular set of policies and themes that I'm looking at are the one area where I think there's a new kind of space that's opened up in the last few years in counterterrorism policy. And what's interesting about this space is that it's a policy area where people talk about things that sound very nice from a liberal point of view. People talk about community partnership. People talk about engagement, building relationships between law enforcement and the community, between government agencies and the community. And so my project is really to explore that and to work out what's really happening on the ground and what does that mean for policymakers. And this is an area that has, apart from kind of seemingly moving away from a more coercive approach to counterterrorism domestically, it's also an area that shifts the focus from foreign nationals to American Muslims, okay? Because the kind of narrative that you'll get from counterterrorism policymakers is that the initial threat was perceived to be a threat that was coming from foreign nationals along the lines of something like 9/11. But in the last couple of years, the focus has shifted to American citizens who are Muslim. And people such as Faisal Shazad, who was the person who attempted to car bomb Times Square, or Nidal Hassan, who was the guy who carried out the Fort Hood massacre in Texas. So that's the other kind of trend. And then wrapped up in that is the notion of radicalization, right? Which is not a legal concept. You know, you can talk in law about particular crimes that are defined as terrorism. Radicalization is a much more amorphous term. It's meant to refer to a process by which someone goes from being a normal member of society to becoming a terrorist. But the notion usually implies some kind of theme around ideology. So the idea that that someone can be turned into a terrorist through coming into contact with some kind of extremist ideology, right? And so there's a massive emphasis in law enforcement amongst policymakers around how do you deal with radicalization? And as we get into this subject, I think some of the kind of issues and tensions around that notion will come out, hopefully.
Mm-hmm. Great. So can you give us just an overview of when you are talking about community policing, what do you mean by that?
So the notion of community policing has also become central to this area. And the idea of community policing is that if you think of traditional policing as the police wait for a report of a crime to come in, they then investigate that crime, they make an arrest, and that leads to a prosecution and potentially a conviction. Community policing is the idea that instead of doing that, what the police should be doing is building partnerships with the communities that are both responsible for crime and victims of crime, and approaching this in a kind of problem-solving way. Community is supposed to have an input into how do we address this, not just necessarily through law enforcement measures, but through other agencies that might involve schools, youth workers, various social services. So again, this is a eminently liberal approach to the question of crime. It actually comes out of the UK in the early 1980s as a response to the riots that we were having in the UK back then. We have riots every 10 years, more or less. And so, you know, the riots 30 years ago produced this idea of community policing. It's a wonderfully amorphous concept because whereas you can present it in this liberal way, in practice, what it can mean is drawing in a number of non-policing public bodies into a kind of intelligence gathering and surveillance role that isn't necessarily appropriate for those bodies. Do you want teachers to be kind of identifying young people who are considered to be potential criminals in the future and then passing that information to the police? It can problematize particular communities by saying, okay, this community has a particular problem with crime, and so we need to engage with that community. And depending on a whole load of factors, that can be particularly problematic in terms of stigmatization. So again, a set of complex issues around that.
Mm-hmm. Do you also see that it has the role of, for the larger general public, of just making it seem safer, more calm? I mean, there's the problem on the one end of identifying a problematic community. On the other end, it could be, well, we're actually doing something. We're being proactive in making relationships and making people feel more comfortable with the idea that there's an opportunity to bring people more into the fold and counter that radicalization.
Right. I mean, the kind of the whole rhetoric around counterterrorism has been prevention, okay, preemption. So, and that's been mandated legally at the federal level. The FBI has to take a preventative approach to counterterrorism, and there's incredible pressure within the FBI on every single agent to not be the person who might have missed some opportunity to prevent the next terrorist attack. Okay, that's basically the end of your career, right? So huge incentives to do everything you possibly can that you can imagine doing to prevent any imaginable threat that you might have dreamt up, you know, while you're watching Fox News, you know, the night before. So, one of the things that happens is that you start doing, you start wanting to talk to as many people as possible in the community, right? And you start wanting to build those relationships because, again, this is another potential source of intelligence on the community. And you can present this process as something that is an opportunity for the community to express its concerns back to you. So that opens up a whole set of issues around who are the community representatives that you're engaging with and what's their agenda. That's really where the kind of whole debate in this area starts getting really interesting.
One of the interesting points that you have that you've talked about and in your article is around also comparing this to the work that's been done with anti-gang violence, and as you mentioned, the riots in the UK as well, is that when you're talking about community policing, it does become a benefit when people have a place to go to identify a source of behavior that exists and they can actually report and have work being done on. But the amorphous nature of terrorism makes it harder for the community to engage to actually identify behavior that's going wrong or that's... Could you talk a little bit more about that?
So there's a process that's been going on in the National Security Council which led to a policy paper being published in early August that kind of brought out this idea of a preventing violent extremism policy that used this language of community empowerment as a way to deal with issues of terrorism. Although, of course, they don't use the word terrorism there; they use the word words violence extremism, which is again another of these kind of slightly tricky concepts. So. And what that policy paper does is it says that we need to have some of the same kinds of community-oriented policing approaches that have worked in relation to gangs in relation to radicalization, right? We need to transpose some of those kinds of policy ideas. And one of the key people who kind of forged the community-oriented policing approach in the LAPD, from the kind of early 90s onwards, was one of the key architects of this counter-radicalization policy that's come out of the White House. And so he will tell a story of what happened in LA is that you had a perception in the African-American community in LA that the LAPD was an occupying army, that the community was completely disengaged from the LAPD, and there was no sense in the LAPD that was a problem. They were just quite happy to carry on breaking people's doors down and beating people up, and there was no progress being made around the issue of gangs as a result of that. And the narrative goes on that, you know, at some point the reformers within the kind of senior leadership in LA said, right, we need a community-oriented policing approach, which meant that you go to the civil rights leaders in the African-American community who've been saying you are an occupying army, and you say, okay, what do we need to do for you to partner with us? And the narrative is that you create a win-win situation there because the leaders of that community understand the damage that gang violence is doing to that community, and so once you get the policing right, you can actually have a productive relationship between those community leaders and law enforcement, and what's never said publicly, but what people will say privately, is once you build that relationship, that's when you get the intelligence, right, from the community. So the whole trick is how do you tell a story about building these relationships without reducing it in the public discussion to, well, we need to build these relationships because we need the intelligence, right? Even though that is really the ultimate motivation. Now, transpose that to counter-terrorism or counter-radicalization. In my view, you have two problems. One is, if you want to talk about building a partnership with the community, do you have the civil rights leaders who are gonna actually engage in that way with and build those relationships, right? And are they leaders who are going to be articulating a civil rights argument so that you get that genuine exchange and a genuine win-win for both the law enforcement and the community? Second issue is there actually, you know, something called radicalization going on in the community, as there clearly was gang violence going on in the community, that people can see and recognize and therefore feel motivated to want to build these relationships? And I think for pretty much every Muslim American, radicalization is a word that is problematic because it seems to imply government intervention into radical ideas which are entirely legitimate. First Amendment. You could reframe it in terms of talking about terrorist recruitment, but who's seen terrorist recruitment? Hardly anyone, right? Because it's such a minor phenomenon, and it just doesn't compare to the problem of gang violence. So I think those are the two areas where this really kind of this analogy between counter-radicalization and initiatives to tackle gangs kind of falls apart.
And as you're talking, also what pops into my mind, and we'll probably get some questions from people. I saw eyes lighting up, especially around the gang violence here. I think what also happens is that communities have access to other sectors of government. So it's not just the criminal justice field. So if you're dealing with gang problems in a community, you could talk about jobs, you could talk about education, you could talk about other aspects. Could you talk a little bit about your work with your conversations with people in Houston around both what happens on the ground and how people are connecting with government systems in order to both deal with the threat and it, you know, that they're seeing from the FBI using more of these community policing policies, and also different ways that they're trying to connect into the communities in which they live.
Right. So I spent a bit of time in Houston, Texas, to kind of explore how are these community relationships actually playing out on the ground. What does it actually mean to talk about community partnership between the Muslim community and the FBI or other law enforcement? Who are the people doing the community partnering? So I spoke to some of the FBI people in the Houston field office who work counterterrorism and see this kind of role as a big part of what they do. Very interesting guy there called Brad Deardorff, who's got at least two decades experience doing counterterrorism. Before that, he was a Marine. A lot of Marines, former Marines, have gone into the FBI, partly because Bob Mueller, the director of the FBI, is also a former Marine. Brad Deardorff saw it, you know, spent time in the Middle East as a Marine. He was in Somalia in the early 90s. And if you say to him, where do you think the FBI gets the expertise to kind of make these very difficult judgment calls sometimes around counterterrorism work? He talks about his time in Somalia. He talks about doing counterinsurgency work in Somalia. And what he means by that is when you're in a conflict situation in somewhere like the Middle East, you cannot win just by coercion. You need to build relationships. So you identify what he calls the local tribal leaders. You go and meet with them, you have a cup of tea, you try and be their friend, and then you use those relationships to both manage the legitimacy issues of what you're doing and to kind of get a better sense of what this community looks like that you're involved with. So comes back to Texas, works for the FBI, and wants to do the same kinds of things. So who are the equivalent tribal leaders in Texas? Well, they're the businessmen, right? The prominent businessmen in the Muslim American community. So what you have after 9/11 is, and this is a story that I think is true in a number of places. I think probably most of the major US cities can tell a similar story. Prominent businessmen in Muslim American communities become community representatives, right? Before then, you wouldn't have seen much in the way of a kind of leadership structure for Muslim America. You'd have seen some prominent Arab American organizations. You'd have seen some, you know, some little bits and pieces of community organization here or there, but by and large, you know, nothing much. But after 9/11, you get these figures, these businessmen, who find themselves in this role. You speak to, you know, I've interviewed quite a few of these businessmen now. The guy in Houston, Texas, that I spoke to is an incredibly interesting guy. He made a hell of a lot of money in the 90s running a chain of 50 or so restaurants, and wasn't really involved in doing any kind of community work at all. After 9/11, he decides that as one of the wealthiest people in this community, he needs to step up. So he gets in touch with the FBI, he gets in touch with ICE, all the government agencies, and starts trying to build these relationships in a very kind of well-meaning way. And what you get, the picture that emerges is a picture in which the FBI is selling to these businessmen a particular story of how radicalization works. Right, which is a model that that you can read in a paper that the NYPD published in 2007, which kind of was the first kind of pseudo-academic paper that the NYPD published, which actually they borrowed from the FBI, who'd already had that model in place before them. And what this model kind of talks about is a kind of four-stage process by which someone goes from being a regular Muslim to a terrorist. And the four stages have these kind of slightly pretentious names, which I can never remember, so I shall read them to you. So the stage one is pre-radicalization, which is meant to be the stage of being a regular Muslim. Stage two is self-identification, right? And this is where you start to see someone growing a beard, they change their dress to a more Islamic kind of clothing. Stage three is what's called indoctrination. By this stage, you're a supporter of violence. And then the fourth stage is jihadization, which is when you're actively involved in terrorism of some sort. So it's this second stage of self-identification, which is where the FBI see the community as having such an important role, because they believe that there's a set of indicators, a set of behaviors that are crucial that they know about. That when they want to know if someone comes into your mosque and you've not heard about them before, and they don't seem to have any kind of story about to make sense of that, the FBI wants to know. If someone suddenly starts growing a beard and dresses differently, and the FBI wants to know. If someone suddenly disappears from the congregation and you don't hear about them, again, that's another of these kind of self-identification indicators. So these businessmen are being asked to play this role of organizing in the community to kind of share this analysis and to create a flow of information about these kinds of phenomena back to the FBI. The other aspect of this is they also play a role in kind of managing issues of legitimacy. So earlier this year, for example, the FBI, when NATO started bombing some targets in Libya, the FBI across the country started to do kind of broad-based interviews with anyone who was Libyan or Libyan-American, had some association with Libya. The pretext would be, does Gaddafi potentially have agents in the US who might carry out criminal activity here as some kind of retaliation? But what you're getting is a kind of mapping of a whole community and key individuals within that community. So when that kind of thing has happened before, I mean, it's happened a number of times over, you know, since 9/11, where a particular ethnic group has been identified as an immediate kind of risk and some kind of broad-based interview pattern was initiated. When that's happened in the past, obviously you get frustration and fear and anger coming out of that community. And what happens now is that these kind of community leaders that have this association with the FBI become essential to kind of manage this process, make sure that frustration can be channeled and managed in a way that it doesn't lead to a kind of withdrawal or refusal of people to participate in these interviews. And the third aspect is what's called the counter-radicalization narrative. So this is the idea that these community leaders can play a role in kind of articulating something more ideological about how you should be an American Muslim. And so I've a number of people I've interviewed use this phrase, loose talk, no more loose talk. Which means don't talk about Iraq, don't talk about Afghanistan, don't say things that are anti-American. And so these community leaders kind of articulate this as a way of kind of accommodating themselves into this kind of post 9/11 climate. And of course, if you speak to the FBI agents, they would totally disown that approach because they understand that they can't play that role. It would be unconstitutional. But somehow or other, these community leaders have picked up that this is a part of their role.
Great. And I'm going to open up to questions very soon. I just have one more thing. And just for clarification, and if it's true, to highlight the absurdity, that you said that the indicators included a person who joined the mosque and wanted to become active, as well as someone who dropped out of the mosque.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, those are both indicators that someone is
right.
Heading towards radicalization.
Right, right. If you, the idea is if you drop out of a mosque, then you're switching from the normal kind of Muslim life that you lead to the kind of dangerous underground Muslim life where you might be meeting with extremists in some front room somewhere instead and doing your prayers there. Right, so that's the rationale for that. The kind of new person who turns up to the mosque, the rationale is this a potential extremist who's going to proselytize and try and radicalize the existing congregation, right?
And can you share with us just quickly, what has been the traditional role of the mosque for American Muslims in assimilating them into the American political process?
I think before 9/11, you would have had 100 different answers to that question, right? From the mosque as community center to the mosque as provider of social services to the mosque as political representative, to the mosque as just a place where people go and do their prayers and that's it, right? So after 9/11, I think the mosque becomes, a very different kind of place. Certainly the role that it would have had before 9/11 to a certain extent of being a place where you could find out about, you know, where you could have discussions about Palestine, for example. You know, the sense after 9/11 is that every mosque is under surveillance, and that's not paranoia. I mean, you know, I would suggest that, you know, at least half of the mosques in the United States have informants operating within them. So, you know, that's not paranoia. And so the atmosphere in the mosque is now a place where people will say that they're much less likely to strike up friendships with new people, much less likely to talk about politics, much less likely to talk about some of these issues around what it means to be American and Muslim. So the mosque has changed in that sense.
And now we're going to open it up to questions. Yes, and please identify yourself and speak into the mic.
I didn't have a chance to introduce myself before I came a little late. My name is Sanjay Patil. I work on policing-related issues within the International Harm Reduction Program here at OSF. And prior to joining OSF, I actually worked on police reforms in South Asia. And one of the things that first of all, thank you, Arun, for your talk. I actually find it really interesting, and there were a few points from my personal experience that I want to bring up and then some questions I have. So with police reforms and community-based policing that takes place in South Asia, one of the things that I feel, and I just, you know, it's a comment more, and I'd be interested to know what you think, because of the power imbalance between the community and the police, I personally believe it's incumbent on the police to take the initiative when it comes to outreaching with the community, especially in disempowered, marginalized communities. You can't expect them to go to the police with a plan for better communication, better dialoguing, better collaborative problem solving. So really, like, it is a function of enlightened police leadership that motivates the police to genuinely and sincerely approach the community. That's what I've observed, and I'd be curious to know if you feel the same. The other comment I had was in terms of the distinction between typical community-based policing that involves civilian law enforcement, like, say, the NYPD or LAPD, versus the FBI throws a different element into the mix, because the FBI isn't, you know, locally present at all times, unlike the police, who are, you know, you're constantly in contact mm-hmm. with. So I'd be interested to know, you know, just what your thoughts are on that issue. In terms of questions, and my first question leads to my last point, which is, you know, recently the New York Times revealed that the NYPD was involved with, you know, explicit intelligence gathering domestically. And I'd be curious to know what the blowback was from those revelations, what you've heard and, you know, what you've come across. And then the second question relates to a point you made regarding, you know, relatively speaking, gang violence was so obvious that community members took the initiative to really reciprocate with police outreach, whereas the same may not be the case with, say, anti-terror-related activities. I think that's largely true. I think that's, you know, a correct statement. But I'd be curious to know, in your research, you know, with Minneapolis, St. Paul, and the Somalian community, I mean, part of your question earlier about, you know, dropping out is equivalent to joining, and why is that the case? I believe that part of the profile that they've come up with is because in Minneapolis, St. Paul, people just dropped off the radar and then wound up with the Shabab in Somalia. So from what I gather, from what I read, the community there was initially, like, in favor of liaising with the FBI and really proactively trying to figure out ways why their young people were becoming radicalized, considering they had come to the U.S. either at a very young age or had been born in the U.S. And then it seems like, from what I've gathered, there's been sort of a pendulum shift that they're not as forthcoming in liaising with the FBI, and partly because it's a siege mentality. So I'm just curious from your end, in right. terms of that experience, you know, are there lessons to be drawn from that interaction that are, that can be applicable outside of that particular incident?
Okay. You know, I think you use the phrase enlightened police leadership. I think the level of enlightenment of police leadership is proportional to the extent of its accountability, right? So I think a good community engagement is one way of actually making that accountability real. But I don't think it's something that's just going to come from the police side kind of unilaterally, especially in an area like counterterrorism, where the only thing at the end of the day that makes that, you know, whether it's law enforcement officers or FBI agents, the only thing they're incentivized to do is to stop that next attack. That's actually going to trump everything else. The motivation for respecting the First Amendment to the extent that it exists, which is not obviously 100% by any means, but to the extent that the First Amendment is respected in counterterrorism, it's because of entirely pragmatic reasons, right? To do with delivering results in terms of building relationships with the community, which can be seen as useful for intelligence, which prevents that next attack. Everything comes back to that next attack, right? So I don't disagree with what you're saying, but I think that there is a kind of responsibility on communities and people who want to represent communities to not wait for enlightened police leadership to come down and say to them, here's how we want to work with you. I think there's a responsibility on community leaders to work out what kind of policing do they want in this area, right? And what is that relationship going to be looking like? In relation to Minneapolis, I'm going to Minneapolis and St. Paul next week, so I'll hopefully be able to give a fuller answer to that in the future. But when you talk about the community was initially enthusiastic to kind of talk about this issue and then withdrew. This is where the question of the community becomes, I think we need to make that a bit more complicated, you know, because what you have in the Somali community in Minneapolis, as I understand it, is the question of who leads that community is itself a political question that's up for grabs, right? The community doesn't come ready-made with leaders, right? So you have different factions within that community, each of whom has a different take on this issue, right? Some of whom wanted to say, look, we have a problem in this community and we want to work with the FBI to deal with that problem and build a very close relationship and follow the FBI's analysis of this problem. And other community leaders who wanted to say, we recognize there's a potential problem here, but we are concerned about the FBI violating our civil rights in dealing with that problem, which we think will ultimately be counterproductive, right? And that's the kind of triangle, right? So an antagonistic relationship with the FBI and a warmer relationship with the FBI. The FBI work with the former guy, right? And that's the guy that turns up at the Peking hearings on radicalization to talk about the problem of radicalization in the Somali community and gets the article about him in the national newspaper. The other guy, no one hears about, right?
Failure of the FBI to be locally present as, like, say, a local police department in that
right.
mix.
Well, the FBI people will say, actually, we are better placed to do this community engagement than the police department, because the police department have a mechanical formula for how they do their work, which is, let's put on a computer screen in our office where all the crimes are happening, and we follow those numbers, right? And we don't do anything else but follow those numbers, because that's how they do it, right? And they call that intelligence-led policing, but basically it's follow the numbers of where crimes are happening and investigate and do that. And community engagement often falls off the side of that. So the FBI often see themselves as filling that gap, because because they see that kind of community engagement as so useful for intelligence gathering. And it will vary from place to place, but certainly it's not always the case that that local police departments are doing community engagement, where FBI are just kind of coming in and out of the community and are fair weather friends.
And to interject for a second, to what extent within the larger context does this get played out? So when you're talking about the intrusion of American Muslims and being able to express themselves and talk, is it to the extent that the larger conversation is, or let me rephrase that, when the larger conversation includes critiques about bombing Libya, which includes critiques about our involvement in wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, is the voices of American Muslims given more breath in order to reiterate some of that, or is it still constricted when that larger, because just when you were talking about the limits on First Amendment, that's a tricky thing because it's complicated about different people's access to rights within a larger country. So to what extent is that larger conversation either giving room for more dissent within for American Muslims?
Right. Well, there's kind of two levels. There's the level of kind of the law, right, on this. So you could argue quite plausibly, I would say, that the material support laws around counterterrorism have been used to criminalize legitimate First Amendment discussion of foreign policy, right? So certainly a number of American Palestinians have fallen foul of that, because by talking about Palestine, the argument is that you're indirectly giving material support to Hamas or Hezbollah. And there was a test case around a year ago in the Supreme Court where material support was clarified as including speech, right? So just by actually, if the New York Times ran an editorial talking about Hamas as a legitimate partner in a peace process, there would be a potential legal case there that the government could make that was material support. So that's the legal side, right, which affects a relatively small number of people in very substantial ways, i.e. removal from the country or imprisonment. But the real issue, I think, is the kind of wider cultural issue, right? So it's not so much the legal restrictions on freedom of speech, but the way in which it becomes impossible for a community to talk about certain subjects if it's caught in this bind of being in a situation where its Americanness has a question mark attached to it, where its religion is seen as not another religion in the American mix, but as a ideology of subversion. So in that scenario, plus when you have this very intensive kind of presence of whether it's NYPD or FBI or anyone else, kind of in the community, recording a huge amount of material about that community and what it's saying and what it's doing. What's happened since 9/11 is that community shuts down talking about certain subjects, right? And we've seen that very clearly. And the debate, in that community is, how long do we carry on doing that? Is it now time to say, well, if I'm Arab, then I do have some political views, and it's actually much more American for me to express those political views rather than to kind of, hunker down. Mm-hmm. And that there's nothing more American than that, right? But that argument has been very difficult for people to make over the last 10 years. There are a lot of people who call themselves Mo and Al, when their actual names are Muhammad and Ali, right? A lot of people who you know, their parents have come here, spent huge fortunes on their education, and they find they graduate and there's no one giving them a job. Because of their name, they change their names, right? So that's a reality.
But Pasha?
I think the question I was going to ask, you kind of answered that to some degree, but it was this quote that you have in the article in The Nation that I passed around that I would highly recommend everybody read. But there's this quote that struck me, which is a guy who I presume is one of the community leaders in Houston, who basically says, you take all these rights, right to free expression, right to religious freedom, and you put them in a shoebox and you put them in the closet, and then you become a mainstream American. That's how we want the youth in our community to behave.
Right.
And you were just saying, you know, what is the... So within the community, within these business leaders, is there any kind of a notion that having access to these rights is in any way American, and therefore you shouldn't be asking the youth in their communities to be shoving them into closets and being repressed? And again, if you wanted to expand on that a little bit more.
Right. So yeah, this was the very interesting thing, because when you talk to the FBI people and you kind of pose these questions about you know, where does the First Amendment, where does free speech fit into this? They're completely politically correct about saying, you know, we don't care if some young kid is, you know, going on the internet and saying that America's an evil place, and, you know, anything that they want to say about criticizing American foreign policy, we're not interested in that, right? But then you talk to the community leaders who have these very close relationships with the FBI, and they will be saying things like the Pasha was just saying about, post 9/11, as an American Muslim, you can forget about your freedom of speech rights, you can forget about freedom of religion. Just the phrase is just be a good citizen, which means don't say anything anti-American, don't talk about certain issues. So, you know, and this is there are all kinds of people in the community who are making civil rights arguments, right? The issue is that the engagement that happens from the federal government is not with those people, right? They're the problem, right? The engagement is with the guy who has this model of what it means to be American is to not talk about things. So and often those are businessmen. They're not. They haven't come from a civil rights background. They see these relationships basically as a business relationship, right? So I give you information about what's happening in the community and I get access to the government. If my cousin's on a watch list, I can talk to you about that. You know, if someone's got an immigration issue, you're going to help with that. So this is the problem is that the model of community behind this is one in which it's just assumed that these community leaders represent this community. The community is seen in a very kind of mechanical way, right? We're talking to someone who seems to be a prominent guy in this community, so he must be the best person to speak to, rather than seeing it as up for grabs, right? Who really does represent that community? And the impact is you know, the average young kid who's growing up in that community, who doesn't come from the same wealthy background as this businessman, and who looks at what, you know, looks at the world and may well have certain views and may want to talk about certain issues, feels that there's nowhere to do that. There's no safe space to do that in the community, right? And I would say that ultimately that's the most dangerous situation from a counterterrorism mm-hmm. point of view.
Other questions?
I wonder if you have observations about the potential of the community policing in dealing with radicalization within majority communities.
Right.
You know, because it could be no less potential threat, and it's not so easy to identify business leaders that would speak for the majority community. So how do I identify your potential interlocutors to develop this community policing concept?
Right. Well, you know, the... of course, you never get this kind of idea of community when you talk about the mainstream majority community, right? I mean, who are the leaders of the white community in America? In the UK, where this is kind of been a very similar debate. We had a policy called Preventing Violent Extremism, which was about engaging the Muslim community to build partnerships around counterterrorism. Since that policy was begun, it's become clear that the threat from far right-wing extremism in the UK is equal to the threat from Islamist extremism, right? And the events in Norway this summer kind of add weight to that point. But there's no equivalent policy program to deal with far right extremism, because there isn't the same model of a community. So what you get in relation to far right extremism is the very sound principle that, look, we're just dealing with some individuals here who are committing crimes, and we should investigate those crimes and prosecute them in the usual way, and we don't need to deal with some idea of a wider ideology or a wider community that has some fundamental problem with it. And it would be good to move more in that direction in relation to Islamist extremism as well.
Question in the back.
Hi, sorry. I'm Chris Rogers, the Afghanistan-Pakistan Initiative. So two questions. First, is you spoke a bit about how there's been some, I guess, sort of sense of knowledge transfer between counterinsurgency sort of operations and experiences, U.S. military to domestic law enforcement. And I was wondering whether or not you've also seen that in the context of sort of demobilization, de-radicalization, which is a part of U.S. international operations in Afghanistan, as well as something that goes on amongst intelligence and security agencies in Pakistan as well. And second question has to do with, sort of rigor in observing and documenting these various phenomenon on both sides. So firstly, I would ask about to what degree there's been any sort of, you know, rigorous analysis or identification of indicators to measure what the actual incidence of radicalization is in the United States, because my sense is that, my intuition is that it's incredibly low. And then particularly in contrast to, you know, measuring something like gang violence, right, where there are a range of indicators and ways of measuring this sort of phenomenon in various communities, as opposed to radicalization. Right. And then, so just real quick, and then secondly, on the other side of that, you spoke a lot about sort of infringements as a result of these sort of phenomenon on First Amendment rights. But I would also wonder whether or not, you know, we have, or others have identified, you know, measurable indicators of that kind of infringement. And just to clarify also on the Supreme Court case you brought up as well, I think it's a awful and very unfortunate case, but it is a bit narrower than the way you described. I mean, my sense of it wasn't necessarily that if the New York Times publishes an editorial, then suddenly that's something that could become run afoul of this law, but instead it had to do with actually speech to various groups who might have been identified by the State Department or whatnot. But anyways, that's just to say that it also seems to me that perhaps there needs to be also some more thinking about, you know, rigorously documenting how people's rights specifically are being infringed with respect to First Amendment.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks. There are also transfers around this issue of de-radicalization, right? If you've got, there's two kind of aspects. One is the issue of someone who's been convicted and has spent time in prison, and whether or not there's a process of rehabilitation or some process after they've left prison. And that has not, as far as I know, has not really been something that's been fought through domestically in the US, because I don't know where the whole idea of rehabilitation is in prisons in the US at all, frankly. But, you know, but I mean, certainly in the UK, that's something that's been given a lot of thought, and there are people who are kind of borrowing from the program in Pakistan, Saudi, Indonesia, right? The more interesting aspect in the US is when you have a situation where the FBI have a kid under surveillance who they think is radicalizing, but they don't think there is a criminal predicate to for them to intervene, right? There is a kind of practice that's going on under the radar now, where they will refer that kid to someone in the Muslim community who they trust to do some de-radicalization work with that kid, right? And this is kind of modeled on a program called Channel that was in operation, has been in operation in the UK. It raises a number. I mean, and this is the kind of end game in a way for these partnerships. When you get to the point where the FBI really trust you, this is what you're going to be doing is getting these referrals of individuals, right? Who by definition are not involved in any criminal activity, but have radical views. And your job is to get them out of those radical views on the assumption that if you don't, they're heading towards becoming involved in terrorism in the future. And the reason it's under the radar is because of a number of reasons. One, there's a perception that the people involved in this will be deeply unpopular in their own communities. There's a perception that they may be at risk themselves of harm. And thirdly, it's actually unlawful, as I understand it, for the FBI to go to a member of the public and say, this guy is a potential terrorist, right? It's slander. So for all of those reasons, it's not out in the open, but it happens. And it draws on the same kind of techniques and models that people have talked about in other countries around de-radicalization. So you assess the case. Is this a kid someone who's deeply ideological, or is it someone who's just a little bit disaffected? Is this kid going through emotional problems? Is some kind of emotional problem the root of this rather than anything ideological? If that's the case, address those emotional problems, maybe work with the family. Pressure the kid not to go off to a training camp by talking about how their family would be upset if that happened, or if it's ideological, getting out, you know, some heavyweight religious arguments.
Great. And we have two more questions. Let's start with Bill.
Hi, I'm Bill Vandenberg with the Democracy and Power Fund, U.S. programs. So as a former organizer, I'm maybe unfortunately all too aware that community organizing is, you know, community policing, community organizing, there are distinct parallels. And I also know that community organizing kind of thrives on, even in the with the best of intentions, manipulation and coercion. So I'm wondering, right, you know, if engagement of any sort is appropriate in this realm, what would your model policy look like? I'm also interested to know about the role of imams. You talked about business leaders extensively, but not so much about religious leaders.
Okay,
and then if you could talk about, in your travels, any particularly compelling models of locally based community engagement from within the Muslim community that are identifying new forms of leadership that, you know, because I think in every community now, especially when, you know, progressive-minded folks are up against the wall in politics, they're always like, let's find a business leader to represent us because they have, you know, special credibility in American politics. So if there are models to identify other forms of leadership that they can then come up and address the imbalance of power, extend how the FBI and law enforcement see leadership, so it's more broadly defined.
Hi, I'm Ramesh Singh from Office of Programs. Basic questions, perhaps. The community is sort of being as sort of homogeneous. I hear sort of community as a term that's homogeneous for Muslim. So I wonder whether that can be disaggregated. And I know that we've talked about Somali-related, but whether for the notion of where they come from or where their support lies or whatever other criteria one can imply to see if there is an interaction between whether FBI is a target or community policing or their own behaviors. But similarly, the so-called model citizen, there seems to be a notion of model citizen as well, whether that is a fairly well understood generalized term or it has a variation in different locations or individuals within the establishment.
Okay, thanks. I mean, I think just on that, on the point about homogeneity, you know, when you talk to people in the government, people in the FBI who are doing this work, they totally understand that the Muslim community is not homogenous in the sense of, you know, there's a range of different ethnic backgrounds in play, each of which has a different story. That's not news to anyone, right? What is news, I think, to people is that there are power dynamics within a community, right, around gender, class, age, different political analyses of the situation of Muslim Americans. And that's really where I think the kind of gap is, right, is, you know, the community leaders are often people who are very distanced from the community. There's been this stereotype that Muslim Americans are by and large doctors and lawyers, right? Well, there's just as many cab drivers, and the kind of mythology around Muslim Americans being predominantly professional is kind of statistically inaccurate. So there's a class dimension, the age dimension. I mean, there's a huge difference between people in their teens and 20s who've come of age in the 9/11 moment, right, compared to people who were here before, or who, you know, whose kind of formative experiences in their life weren't in America. And gender is a huge, you know, I mean, very hard to find any women who are Muslim community representatives, right? And the gender story is totally left out of this as well. So, you know, I think those are the kind of dimensions where you want to see power relationships within the community as well as between the community and the police or the government, right? It's the relationships within the community that are often left out and which community organizers are all too familiar with, right? It's kind of the bread and butter of community organizers. And I think that, you know, are there alternative models out there of how to do community organizing? I think there are many. And I think there's a kind of energy of lots of different folks trying to think through these issues on the ground, right? There's a fantastic organization in Queens called Drum, which I think has some really interesting model around this. There's Access in Dearborn, which I think, you know, really think through this stuff as well. The issue is that they're not often the groups that get to have the airtime, get to have the you know, sit in the meetings with government. So, you know, I think there's some really interesting work being done around this in those kind of organisations. The question of imams, you know, again, this is the imams are kind of depending on again, you know, you're not going to get a simple answer to this. There's a huge range of roles that imams see themselves as having, right? So in some places, imams are very respected community leaders themselves, right? In other places, I mean, for example, in Houston, the imams get an email every Thursday, right, from the businessman telling them what's going to be in the sermon that Friday, right? So, you know, they're functionaries. They're not leaders in Houston.
Right. Is there any last burning question before we give Arun a chance to give a summary statement, and then we'll conclude?
Summary statement, okay. Okay. And how long do I have for my summary statement? A minute.
A minute.
Okay. Okay, well, look, I think the main thing that I think really strikes me out of this whole area is that the notion of community that we use has been far too simplistic, right? We haven't attended enough to the power dynamics within a community. We've assumed that communities come with their leaders ready-made, whereas actually those leaders are produced through a much more complex process. And one of the interesting things about coming from the UK to this debate is in the UK, you know, the so-called model of multiculturalism from the UK, which has been very legitimately criticized, one of the things it did do is politicize this question of who speaks for the community. Because when you have a policy in the UK of saying, okay, the local authority is going to fund community organizations to represent communities, the question of who does that is straight away political, right? And the whole debate within kind of black and minority ethnic communities in the UK for the last 30 years has really been who speaks for us. And it seems to me that has not been as prominent certainly in Muslim American communities.
Great. Well, I want to thank Arun so much for sharing his thoughts with us today. I think that our conversation really touched on a lot of issues that we grapple here, especially putting it within a U.S. context, the role of communities here, how we are struggling with both different levels of engagement of communities, which I think we're wanting, and engagement of the police and having a helpful role in both keeping us safe and keeping us feeling a part of the community and the larger community, and how we struggle with this question of identity and pluralism in a country that, you know, you could say has always gone through change, but in this particular moment of looking at the Muslim community in America, where Americans see that. A recent poll was done by the Brookings Institute and Public Religion Research Institute, finding that Americans still have an overwhelming majority support of religious freedom, and that this should be a country that supports even religions that they disagree with. But that poll also showed that there's still 30% of people who are not comfortable with Islam. And you could say on a positive that 70% are, but that there is this sense of a growing concern around how Americans are accepting religious pluralism. And as I mentioned to Arun, this in this particular survey, they also talked about how 40% of Americans don't understand that Mormonism is a Christian faith. So it's a general ignorance that goes along, because that's an American-bred religion there that still the majority of Americans are still uncomfortable with or learning to grow and understand. But I think that challenge is something that we are really pushing through and really looking at opportunities and models for how do you have inclusion, how do you have keeping the great tradition of dissent within America for all people and newer communities as well, especially to embrace that, and then how that change will help make a different and better America as well. So thank you all for coming out and participating in this discussion. It will be up on a website and podcast in a few weeks. And a special round of applause for Arun.
Thank you very much.